and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu, and I'm joined by Katie Balls and Fraser Nelson. Brexit Secretary Dominic Raab held a press conference with Michel Barnier after the two met in Brussels. Katie, how did it go?
I think there was good news and there was bad news for the UK government and from Theresa May's perspective. The good news, I suppose, is the fact that they've now promised to continuous Brexit negotiations in a bid to try and bridge these differences as we get much closer to the EU withdrawal agreements supposed to be being drawn up. And that means that we're expecting it to be about weekly that the two sides will now meet. I think the less good news was when it was suggested to Barnier that he was inflexible and the EU had an inflexible approach to these negotiations. And he appeared to double down on his position, saying, well, yes, we haven't changed our position, but why would we change our position over the past 2 years? Because ultimately, we're not the ones who decided Britain should leave. We are the EU. We stay as we are. We have our principles when it comes to the single market, and we're not planning to move. He did say that he hoped to have an agreement with the UK of unprecedented scope. But I think ultimately it was more signs that the European Commission is very rigid. Now, number 10's big gamble isn't that the European Commission is a pragmatic organisation. No one thinks that. It's that the EU member states are more pragmatic and they could get the EU Commission, so people like Barnier, to soften it. We'll find out next month if there's any chance of that happening when all the EU leaders meet in Salzburg.
It sounds really boring, but there's a big difference between the EU Council, which is, Theresa May, Angela Merkel, and all the various other heads of government, and the EU Commission, which is Barnier and Juncker and the various bureaucrats. Now, I think Brits, because we're so uninterested in how Brussels works, tend to conflate the two. We tend to think that eventually the Commission will do whatever they're told, that Angela Merkel will just click her fingers and then things will fall into line. Well, there have been two big changes in the last year or so. One is that Angela Merkel's fingers don't click anymore. She's lost her authority at home, and she's basically on political life support from her other fellow Europeans. The other thing is that the EU Commission is becoming like self-aware, like kind of Skynet in Terminator. You're getting this bureaucratic organisation, which has in Juncker somebody who wasn't picked by the other heads of government, and it's got in Martin Selmayr a very powerful and ambitious civil servant who is wanting to give the Commission its own identity. And recently, you're seeing clashes between the various functionaries in the EU Council and the EU Commission. In other words, they're not obeying orders. Even if Theresa May has a magically successful tour around various European capitals, it doesn't therefore follow. But they're going to go and tell Barnier, OK, we want you to do this deal or to do that deal. They don't call the shots, not in the way that they once did. And this is one of the many reasons that I'm by no means confident there is going to be a deal.
Katie, you also mentioned that it looks as if Dominic Raab is going to Brussels quite more frequently now than in the future. Has he already done more as Brexit Secretary than David Davis was doing?
I think it's what you define, the workload as. David Davis's allies would obviously dispute such a claim. But there are some fun stats, I think, going around on social media which suggested that Dominic Raab has gone to Brussels more, in his first few weeks in the job than David Davis did in several months. I think the role of Brexit Secretary has certainly changed since Dominic Raab moved into it. When David Davis was there, there was a constant tension between Number 10 and the Department for Exiting the European Union over basically the hierarchy and who said what. David Davis and his advisers thought that he should be leading the negotiations, but Theresa May seemed to prefer to lead that to Ollie Robbins, the civil servant despised by some Brexiteers who was moved to Number 10. Now that Dominic Raab is in the Brexit Department, I think that hierarchy has been established. Dominic Raab defers to Theresa May. He's basically the Prime Minister's deputy, and that means he listens to Number 10 first. So he's accepted his place in the order in a way that David Davis never did. That said, I think what Dominic Raab has done perhaps quite successfully is he's basically reimagined himself as the Minister for No Deal. So although he doesn't have much of a role perhaps in steering the negotiations, he does take control of preparing for that eventuality. And that means that while we have Jeremy Hunt touring the world, basically putting his name to the Chequers plan, and trying to sell it, Dominic Raab's keeps a little bit separate to that by talking more about no deal, which I think is probably a little less toxic to potential leadership ambitions.
I could be wrong, but I thought I detected a slight difference in Michel Barnier's tone in the press conference as well. I mean, normally he's been saying, oh, this isn't very good, I'm afraid, Britain, you're not impressing me, you might be in real trouble here. I detected a lot less of that this time. A note of, I wouldn't say panic, but certainly he seems to take more seriously the idea that Britain might just walk away. Now, you get some bookmakers now who think that this is the most likely option. No deal is not just possible, but the single most likely option. And you're already beginning to get quite a few Conservatives who are, I'm talking to anyway, who are beginning to reconcile themselves with no deal. Even some of them are beginning to look forward to it. So there could be the sense that the Tories are almost giving up on the prospect of a deal and are already beginning to throw forward thinking, what preparations do we need to walk away? And remember, the European Commission is very bad at judging the mood of the Conservative Party. They refused to give Cameron a deal, thinking that the Tories would crumble. And in fact, they didn't, and neither did the electorate when they voted in the referendum. So I think Michel Barnier is beginning to wonder if he's pushed a little bit too far in saying that all the onus is on Britain to come to the European Commission with a deal and not on the Commission to go to Britain with something that would get past Parliament.
And speaking of a no deal, just how prepared are we? Tomorrow, the technical notices will start to come out. But Katie, today we found out that the NHS has barely started to prepare for a no deal. Are you surprised?
Well, I think people within the Department of Health would dispute such claims, but it comes after earlier this week there was a leaked email to Simon Stevens, the NHS England boss, which suggested that NHS providers were worried that there hadn't been enough preparations on no deal planning and how that was all going to work out. Now, I think when it comes to these doomsday warnings about no deal, lots of them people dismiss, certain lorry car parks or stockpiling food. But there is the question of medicine and the fact that we do rely on, you know, other countries which are our European neighbours for some of the transfers and ways around that. But I think in a way, because it's been such a glaring priority and because there is the scope for it to go wrong, is actually one of the areas where the government are pretty well prepared, where they have gone over. But we'll find out, obviously, from tomorrow when we start to get these technical notices. And it's interesting. I do sense that some government departments are more twitchy than others about how these are going to play out.
When you think about it, the only way we'd possibly have medical shortages is if the British government were to hold them up in customs. Now, if there were no deal, it's far more likely that the British government would say, OK, we're going to let everything from Europe through. Maybe we should be charging tariffs, but we're going to exercise our right not to do that. And even if they weren't to take this relatively straightforward way ahead, they could then fast-track medical supplies. Again, that's not beyond the wit of man. So I think the idea of medical shortages, kind of Venezuelan-style medical shortages, are pretty far-fetched, really. And I also think it's doing damage to... I think there should be concern about no deal and preparations for it, but when you start to come up with stories like this, I think it stretches credulity to the breaking point, and it's more than likely to make people think, as we did in the referendum, no, these scare stories are simply not credible, therefore I'm not going to worry about it at all. I mean, I don't think for a minute that the government is properly prepared for no deal. I think it would be, you know, incredibly turbulent if it were to take place. But I think the last thing to get affected would be medical supplies. I mean, the government may be chaotic, but when it comes to getting things through like this, it is very easy to arrange.
And I think with transferring medicines, there are some things where they do need to make sure that they are still done swiftly because a delay could affect it. But I think what doesn't help the cause is when we get stories such as, you know, Brexit will lead to super herpes, which is might have been gonorrhea, one of the two, which is a story that was doing the rounds a few weeks ago. And it does just sound like Project Fear, and actually it's about working out the legitimate problems.
And last, in some other news, today Michael Gove proposed a ban on puppy and kitten sales in pet shops. Fraser, is this a continuation of Michael Gove's cuddly millennial rebrand?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I remember I was at the with Katie at the launch of this Onward think tank. What was it, 3 months ago, Katie, now?
Yeah.
And Ruth Davidson was the guest speaker, and she was made this little joke. She was saying, oh, you guys want to rebrand the Conservatives and make them soft and cuddly. You want to come up with an agenda. But then you thought, hang on, we're overthinking this. Let's just get the pregnant lesbian to come along and represent us, you know? And she was kind of joking at her own tokenism. But there's a lot of truth to what she's saying. When Michael Gove is thinking, look, we're overthinking the ideology. Let's just be the champion of the puppies and kittens, and let's ban these third-party puppy and kitten sales, and let's take up the crusade of kittens being taken away from their mothers too early. So, you know, Gove has got a certain touch with this. So he was the sort of the brains, if you can call it that, behind David Cameron's kind of Hug a Husky makeover back in 2005. He was the great campaigner behind banning plastic. He's got a sort of, as a former journalist, he's got a sense for what things Middle England is likely to get upset about, and wants to align the Conservatives behind motherhood, apple pie and baby kittens.
I think DEFRA, since the snap election, I mean, Theresa May has no majority. It's very hard to get lots of, you know, new legislation through. So there's been a real struggle for domestic policies. Michael Gove very efficiently has filled that hole by like coming up with lots of notices that aren't very expensive, that are crowd pleasers. So I think this is another example of the government looking like it's doing something that isn't Brexit. But I do think Michael Gove now has a rival when it comes to a department that's getting stuff done, because speaking to Conservatives over the past few days, and they say actually the Home Office, where Sajid Javid is now also making waves. It seems to be a department that has managed to break free somewhat of the, you know, the fact that you can't do much. You've had the cannabis medicine policy, and we're seeing more movement there. So I think Michael Gove now has competition.
And also Sajid Javid's achievements are, dare I say, rather more substantial than Michael Gove's. I mean, Michael Gove is a great campaigner, but he's in the Environment Department. There's only so much you can do. Sure, you can do a campaign against plastic, get the Daily Mail to back you, talk about puppies and kittens and be photographed stroking them. But if Sajid Javid's plan goes according to his agenda anyway, we will have within a few weeks perhaps students taken out of the immigration cap. That's next on his list, with the immigration bill coming through Parliament. You would have perhaps a more liberal immigration policy. You would have, he's promising to talk to those affected by the Windrush deportations now and issue apologies to them. Now, I don't think that Gove and Javid are doing this so they can fight each other for the leadership via proxy. But both are examples of what happens if you have competent ministers running departments with just a little bit of imagination and a little bit of energy. I wish every single department in the government was doing as much and coming out with as interesting things as the Home Office and the Department from the for the Environment. And I think it's both of these guys, I think, show a lesson to the rest of the cabinet colleagues as to how politics can make a difference, and you can change the record from Brexit if you just think about it properly.
Thanks both. This podcast is called Coffee House Shots. If you liked it, do subscribe on your podcast provider and let us know what you think on the iTunes store. We also have a special summer offer. Get a free thermal insulated Spectator water bottle when you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/water. Thanks for listening.